From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast.
Welcome to the November 2022 episode of the Bletchley Park podcast. Torch to Tunis. The Allied victory in the Second Battle of El Alamein in November 1942 proved to be the beginning of the end of the war in North Africa. But many months of hard fighting and the opening of a whole new front in northwest Africa would be needed before the Allies were finally able to kick Axis forces off that continent for good. Though often forgotten about today, the Operation Torch landings were a pivotal event which led to the first battles between German and American forces. These troops and the intelligence personnel who supported them had to learn their trade quickly in the toughest of circumstances. In this It Happened Here episode, Bletchley Park's research officer, Dr. Thomas Cheetham, reveals how these lessons would prove fundamental to the Allied use of intelligence later in the war. This episode is hosted by Exhibitions Manager Erica Munro. As usual, many thanks to Dr. Ben Thompson and Owen Mugan for voicing our archival documents.
This is Bletchley Park. It happened here.
In this episode, we're looking at events that took place 80 years ago. Thomas, could you tell us about the situation with the war at that time in late 1942?
Yes, so late 1942 really, in retrospect at least, is the turning point of the war. On the Eastern Front, you have the Germans losing the Battle of Stalingrad. They're besieged in Stalingrad during the winter and then finally surrender early in 1943. In the Pacific, you have Japanese being held at bay at the Battle of Midway, and that's the naval battle which really means that the Japanese aren't going to be dominant in the Pacific. They're not quite losing, but they're not going to win from that point onwards. And in the desert in North Africa, you have the battles of El Alamein, which turn the tide in the favour of the British and eventually lead to the Axis being kicked out of North Africa for good.
Battles, plural.
Yeah, there's two battles of El Alamein, and there's another battle called the Battle of Alam Halfa in the middle. And the first of those battles is under Claude Auchinleck. He's Commander-in-Chief Middle East. At that point, he stops the German advance on Egypt, and then the other two battles are involved in basically starting the process of pushing them back again. And those are under new command, especially General Montgomery comes in to command 8th Army. And that's a very important turning point in the war in the desert. Before we talk about what happens after El Alamein, it would be good to talk about what Montgomery manages to achieve, which sets the stage for what comes up a little bit later.
In that case, do tell us a bit about that from an intelligence point of view. Why is El Alamein of particular interest?
Monty is very well supplied with intelligence. He's also well supplied with men and tanks and planes and everything you need to fight a war. But so were his predecessors. So what changes when Monty comes in is not just down to material superiority or just new intelligence. It's also down to having a new way of fighting the war. And we see in the way he uses Ultra, he uses it as a simple tool to tell him what the enemy is going to do, but he also uses it to support morale in a way. And this is the real problem 8th Army is having at the time. They've been pushed all the way back to Egypt and their morale is at rock bottom. There's a historian called Jonathan Fennell who's done a lot of work on this and talks about how the 8th Army went through a morale crisis in the summer of 1942 and they just didn't have faith. They were materially superior to the Axis forces, but they didn't have belief in themselves and belief in the leadership and belief in their equipment and in their training that they needed to win these battles. And what Monty manages to do when he comes in is turn that situation around very quickly and rejuvenate the whole effort in the 8th Army. And then they win the Battle of El Alamein and the rest is history. He's very clear and concerted in how he wants to do this. He comes in and immediately he starts to give orders saying, things are going to be different now. We are going to beat the enemy. We can do it. I want every man to be told that this is going to happen. He actually gives orders to burn all the plans for retreat to Egypt. Actually, there probably aren't any plans for retreat to Egypt. Auchinleck has already stopped the German advance, and there's probably no intention of retreating any further. But Monty makes this point that they're not going to go any further back. They're going to win the battle here or they're going to die.
Front North Africa. Panzer gehen vor. arbeiten sich vor und dringen in kühnem Angriff in die britischen Verteidigungslinien ein. Die harten und erbitterten Kämpfe in Afrika gehen weiter.
The key point here from our point of view is that Ultra gives him the ability to make these promises about how the battle is going to go and then keep them, because he knows what the Germans are going to do.
Remind us, when you say Ultra, what do you mean by Ultra?
Ultra is the code word for intelligence derived from high-grade German and Italian ciphers, and actually of course Japanese ciphers as well, that's sent out to commanders in the field. And we have these links of special liaison units who take the information broadcast from Wadden Hall near Bletchley Park, and they share it with commanders in the field. The course of events is quite interesting here. Monty takes over on the 13th of August 1942. On the 17th, he gets Ultra intelligence that Rommel plans an attack on his position. And he'd already actually anticipated where this was going to take place, at the Alamhaufer Ridge. And on the 24th of August, he gives precise details, and then Rommel attacks on the 30th of August. So he has very good intelligence about what Rommel's going to do. And to use the words of Ralph Bennett, who talks about it in his book, Ultra's priceless gift to Montgomery was a confirmation, a fortnight before battle was joined, that his instinct was right and that victory was certain if his orders were carried out strictly. So what he's able to do is promise to his troops and ensure this is spread around the army. This is what's going to happen in the forthcoming battle. And then it all goes exactly to plan. And that is a really important step in restoring the confidence of the troops and putting them in a position where they're not able to just defend but start going forwards.
We often say that Ultra intelligence gives perhaps vague details or a better picture of the situation. But here it seems to have just given Rommel's game away.
Yeah, it gives the whole plan away. They know exactly what he's going to do. And while you're right, we shouldn't overstate how often that happens. And we shouldn't underestimate how important the general picture is that Ultra builds up in this case and in a few other cases in this story. It is quite simple. It tells Allied commanders what the enemy's going to do and then they can just directly counter it. But the morale angle of this, I think, is really interesting. And it's something which actually is understood at the time. And it's talked about by Bill Williams, who is Montgomery's intelligence chief in the desert.
Ultra, and Ultra only, put intelligence on the map. From 1939 to 1942, intelligence was the Cinderella of the staff. And information about the enemy was frequently treated as interesting rather than valuable. Yet the story of the short but drastically successful battle at Alamhaufer may point the moral best. The brave but battled 8th Army was holding an improvised line at El Alamein. A new commander arrived in the desert. It became obvious from Ultra that Rommel intended his final drive to Alexandria in the full moon of August by a sweep through the southern flank. The army commander accepted the evidence and made his arrangements. Believing that the confidence of his men was the prerequisite of victory, he told them with remarkable assurance how the enemy was going to be defeated. The enemy attack was delayed, and the usual jokes were made about the crystal gazers. A day or two later, everything happened according to plan. The morale emerging from the promise, so positively fulfilled, formed the psychological background conditioning the victory which was to follow. Thereafter, intelligence came into its own. We had had good intelligence before. Henceforward, we were going to use it.
Extract from The Use of Ultra by the Army by Edgar Bill Williams. National Archives file W0208/3575.
And the other thing Bill Williams talks about is how finally they're going to use intelligence properly. They've had it before, now they're going to respect it. It's not going to be so much of a Cinderella branch of the military. They're going to use it effectively going forwards. And that's exactly what happens. It makes an interesting contrast to what's going on at the other end of North Africa with Operation Torch, where the British and American troops involved in that operation and their commanders have very little experience by comparison to the 8th Army. And they're going to have to go through the same sort of learning process, but in a much shorter space of time.
Here we will stand and fight. There will be no further withdrawal. I have ordered that all plans and instructions dealing with further withdrawal are to be burnt. And at once, we will stand and fight here. If we can't stay here alive, then let us stay here dead. I want to impress on everyone that the bad times are over They are finished. Our mandate from the Prime Minister is to destroy the Axis forces in North Africa. I have seen it, written on half a sheet of notepaper. It can be done, and it will be done, beyond any possibility of doubt. What I have done is to get over to you the atmosphere in which we will now work and fight. You must see to it that this new atmosphere permeates right down through the Eighth Army, right down to the most junior private soldier. The great point to remember is that we are going to finish with this chap Rommel once and for all. Now, my forecast of this battle is that there will be three definite stages. First, the break-in to the enemy's positions, then the dogfight, and then the breakout. We will do the break-in on the night of the 23rd of October. The dogfight battle will then begin, and it will involve hard and continuous fighting. I believe that the dogfight battle will become a hard-killing match and will last for 10 or 12 days. The enemy will crack. Then will come the breakout, and that will lead to the end of Rommel in Africa. Make no mistake about that.
So tell us more about Operation Torch.
Operation Torch is a plan to land troops in French North Africa, in Morocco and Algeria, and hopefully capture Tunisia as well. What this comes out of is a compromise between British and American approaches to fighting the war, and it starts off very early. They start talking about this at the Arcadia Conference in December 1941, so only a few weeks after America's joined the war. And that's where they agree things like the Germany First policy from America's point of view. And these plans go through various stages, and they're finalised in the middle of 1942 to take place in November. The Americans, from the very beginning, want to land in France and take the fight to the enemy. The British are always much more cautious about that. And they point out, probably quite correctly, that if we land in France, we may be able to seize a foothold, but we're not in a position where we have the forces to take on the German army head on at this point. And if that operation goes wrong, it could be very, very damaging. The British don't think they can land in France for another couple of years. And Churchill manages to persuade Roosevelt, who then lays down to his generals, that they're going to have to think about alternatives, and the alternative that presents itself is a landing in North Africa. It's still under the control of the French. After the Battle of France, the French have signed an armistice with Germany, and part of the country's been occupied by Germany, and part of it's been left mostly independent under the Vichy regime. And as we talked about in the Fall of France podcast, this is a compromise for the Germans. The main thing they're worried about is the French fleet, that it doesn't fall into Allied hands. So if they leave a sort of French rump state that controls the fleet and enforces its neutrality, then they keep all those battleships out of Allied hands, which is good for the Germans. So they agree to this compromise. And that means the whole situation in North Africa is incredibly complex. There are major diplomatic sensitivities. The landing forces don't quite know whether the French soldiers are going to fight or whether they're going to surrender or even defect to the Allies at that point. They have to balance the concerns of the Free French, of course, in all of this as well. And there's a complexity that the USA has recognised the Vichy regime and the British haven't. So all of these issues have to be dealt with very carefully. And the plan that they eventually come up with is to land three forces, two in Morocco and one in Algeria. And this leaves one of those forces on the correct side of the Straits of Gibraltar, so that if Spain joins the war in support of Germany, mm-hmm. and we know Spain at this point, the fascists have won the civil war, they have a fascist regime in Spain, and they're a friend of Germany, it means that the whole Allied invasion forces are going to be cut off if Spain decides to intervene. So there's a lot of diplomatic complexity and a lot of care that goes into the planning of these operations. What that means is that they can't send a force all the way to Tunisia. It's just too far, it's too risky, it's too close to German airfields in Sicily. They hope to grab Tunisia, but they're going to have to race to get there before the Germans do if they decide to try and secure it. And it's worth noting there are no German forces in Tunisia at this point. It's French territory. There are only French forces there. So equally for the Germans, if they want to disrupt Torch, they're going to have to get troops on the ground as quickly as possible. So it's going to be a logistics race as well.
Dash to Tunis.
For both sides. Yeah. Absolutely.
This is not recorded in the desert.
sound you can hear now is the noise of British tanks moving into battle. It's the night of Sunday, Monday, November 1st, 2nd. And it's the early hours of the morning, and now on this desert, with the sand clouds whirling up behind each vehicle, British tanks in large numbers are moving into battle. Shells by the thousand are being pumped into the enemy. And now here we are at the side of one of these desert tracks, watching the armed might of the 8th Army go forward to engage the enemy. The moon, just half a moon, is shining down here, the starry night, and overhead there's not only the moon, but the flares which have been dropped, which are shining down on the desert and illuminating this battleground. Tank after tank is going past, just a few yards from the microphone as I speak now. One can't see very clearly. It's rather like being in a fog. It is indeed a fog, but the fog is a fog of sand, because the sand's very soft here, and each tank as it goes past churns up a great cloud.
We've spoken about the value of intelligence and good intelligence, and you've shown how useful it can be. How was intelligence used in this particular plan that you've been telling us about?
Well, intelligence is very heavily integrated into the plan from the beginning, and that's because the British especially, and the Americans are following them, have a good understanding of its value at this point, and they want to make sure they use it as well as possible. So they're doing standard stuff. They're trying to gauge what the German reaction might be with their intelligence. They're trying to run deception operations to distract them. The Germans don't anticipate torch, and they actually think, when they look at the Allied shipping, that it's probably American forces going to Egypt rather than planning a landing at the other end of North Africa. So the deception operations are successful as well.
Deception operations weren't run out of Bletchley Park, though, just to be clear.
No, they weren't. They were run in North Africa at this point by a chap called Dudley Clark, which is a fascinating story in its own right. And of course, a little bit later, we will have Operation Mincemeat, which is the most famous deception. And that's, again, supported by intelligence from Bletchley Park. But they're not running those operations from here. There's a certain amount of intelligence work going on to gauge what's going on in French North Africa as far as the resistance is concerned and the chances of defections happening. And there's also an interesting side story in something we don't talk about enough, which is the traffic of the German intelligence services. At this point in the war, they have agents in Spain on both sides of the Straits of Gibraltar, because the Spanish have a small possession on the other side of the Straits from mainland Spain. And they're trying to spot Allied ships as they sail through the Straits. For this reason, the Allies are only sailing through at night, so they can't be spotted. But they discover that the Germans are making arrangements to set up a series of infrared sort of beam stations. And these will be able to detect a ship from the heat given off by its funnels and things like that, even if it's sailing at night. And this is called Operation Bodden by the Germans. And because the Allies find out about this, they're able to make an intervention with the Spanish through their ambassador and persuade the Spanish to stop the Germans setting up these infrared detectors.
You say the Allies find out about this. Is this through SIGINT?
Absolutely, yes. They're breaking traffic of the German intelligence services talking about planning this operation, and then they're able to, without telling the British ambassador in Spain where they know the intelligence from, because it can't get back to the Spanish, of course, but they're able to make this diplomatic intervention and help to hinder what the Germans are planning. So all of these operations are helping to lay the ground and make the chances of success in the invasion more likely. And with the invasion forces themselves, you have intelligence being integrated. So from the beginning, these forces have special liaison units attached to them. At this point in the war, the special liaison units have been in North Africa for a couple of years, since April 1941. But they're still relatively small scale. You've basically got one unit serving the main headquarters in North Africa, but that's it. For Operation Torch, there will be five SLUs organised to serve all the main headquarters, newly founded from scratch, trained up to do the specific job because they now know what works. And the other thing that happens is you have experienced intelligence officers, many of them from Bletchley Park, who are attached to the commands to advise on the interpretation of what the SLUs are receiving. And you have the usual tactical why going on.
When we're talking about tactical why, who was actually doing it?
So the Army and the Air Force have teams that go out into the field with radios mounted on trucks, and they have enemy code books and a certain amount of information about the enemy networks. And they listen to communications going on in the theatre where those units are fighting. So field intercept units listening to not high-level strategic stuff, but what's going on just on the other side of the wire, and trying to break low-grade enemy codes or just look at the patterns of traffic. and then tell the commanders they're attached to what's going on just a few miles away. And these are separate from special liaison units, which take information directly from Bletchley Park. So they're handling high-grade material. Technically speaking, you have two parts. You have special communications units, which deal with the wireless links back to the UK. And you have the special liaison unit itself, which deals with cyber security and with the security, of course, of the intelligence. But they're not listening to enemy signals. That's the job of the tactical Y units. And also there is a system of RAF, what they call signal computers, which are placed on warships to alert them if they're going to be attacked by an enemy aircraft, because they can listen in on the air-to-ground communications of the aircraft and work out what the enemy air forces are up to.
These RAF signal computers are people.
Yes, they are computers in the old sense before we invented the automatic version. But again, they're trained by Bletchley Park. In many cases, they're informed by intelligence coming out of here. So there are many, many tendrils of influence that Bletchley Park is exerting on the preparation of this campaign.
You've explained to us how valuable intelligence can be, how much, for example, Montgomery appreciated it, but we know that it needs to be used well by commanders, and the employment of that intelligence is actually key. How far were the commanders here in Operation Torch prepared to use the information they were being sent?
Well, I suppose in short, they're supported as well as possible, but they're not experienced. And this goes for both British and American commanders. They're not really well trained in the use of intelligence at the start of the war, you know, coming to this fresh. And the British have learned their trade by hard experience, but the Americans haven't had that opportunity yet. So what we see is several experienced British figures are attached to the American commands to provide support. And the American commander of this operation, of course, is General Eisenhower. He goes down to Gibraltar to plan the operation. And he's joined there by Eric Mockler Ferryman, who's been in charge of intelligence for home forces in the UK up to this point. He's a professional soldier. He's very experienced in the way the British do intelligence. And another interesting figure is his chief air intelligence officer, who is Wing Commander Humphreys, formerly of Hut 3, who we've seen on this podcast before. He's one of the people involved in this rather fraught period of discontent in Hut 3 that ends up with him and his army compatriots being shifted to other jobs and Eric Jones being brought in to run Hut 3. Even though Humphreys had caused so much problem in Hut 3 by being more of a representative of the RAF than a loyal member of GCNCS, he's evidently very well regarded, especially by Frederick Winterbottom, who's in charge of the Ultra system and the SLUs. So he goes out to North Africa to provide support there. The naval headquarters has an officer from Naval Section at Bletchley Park. And so Eisenhower is surrounded from the beginning by good intelligence people, almost all of whom are British, to provide the support he needs. And for him, it will be a formative experience in commanding troops, but also in learning how to use intelligence well. And he's very well supported in that.
Did they tend to want to accept the intelligence without question, or were they more sceptical of it? Or do you think they were being steered strongly by the British in being selective in how they used it?
I would definitely say at this point, Eisenhower is on the sceptical end. That's probably a good thing, though, because you never want to trust your intelligence too much or place too much faith in it. It can only tell you so much, even when it's very, very good quality. Even Ultra, even this sort of the best intelligence source that's ever existed, it still has major limitations, and those need to be understood. So it's a good thing, I think, Eisenhower didn't go in gung-ho and was a bit more cautious. I think that set him in good stead.
This is the BBC Home and Forces programme. This is Bruce Belfridge. Here's some excellent news which has come during the past hour in the form of a communique from GHQ Cairo. It says, the Axis forces in the Western Desert, after 12 days and nights of ceaseless attacks by our land and air forces, are now in full retreat. It's known that the enemy's losses in killed and wounded have been exceptionally high. Up to date, we've destroyed more than 260 German and Italian tanks and captured or destroyed at least 270 guns.
So speaking of going in, the invasion went ahead, bolstered by this strong intelligence supporting team.
Yeah, absolutely. So it goes ahead on the 7th of November. And this is right in the middle of the Second Battle of El Alamein. It's timed perfectly to disrupt what the Germans are doing in North Africa. But I think we forget about Operation Torch because it seems to go quite smooth in retrospect. There is some hard fighting. There is a naval battle with the French fleet in which ships are sunk. There are also some parts of the operation that don't go very well at all. So there are operations to land in the harbours in Oran and Algiers, which are two of the major bases for the French fleet in North Africa. And these forces literally sail into the harbour, flying British and American flags, and hope that the French won't consider them hostile. Well, they do consider them hostile. And in one case, Operation Reservist at Oran, they take 80% casualties to the attacking forces.
Wow.
Which almost never happens. And Algiers, they don't take such serious casualties, but that's because almost all of them are captured very quickly. So the French forces do their duty and put up a fight against an invading force, as you might expect they would. However, the landings in other places, when they're not trying to land directly into a harbour, they go better. They do overcome the defenders. And after a couple of days of fighting, an armistice is agreed. This is a controversial event because it involves talking to Admiral d'Arlon. He's basically the French High Commissioner in North Africa. He's also a fascist and a collaborator with the Nazis. And the fact that the Allies end up agreeing this armistice with him causes some consternation back home. And Eisenhower justifies it on the basis of, well, I'm the man on the ground, and this was a way to bring the battle to a swift conclusion. And Admiral d'Arlon was the person who could make that happen. But it definitely doesn't sit well with people in Washington that they've made this deal with a fascist. Admiral d'Arlon, as a side note, he's actually assassinated shortly after this by not a member of the Free French, but actually a French monarchist. So that gives you an idea of the complexity of the political situation here.
Yeah.
The Allies are having to navigate. But at this point, they sign the armistice, the French forces basically defect to the Allies, and they've secured Morocco and Algeria. Fantastic. But then we have the German response.
Mm-hmm.
And so the Germans very quickly, they occupy the rest of France, occupy the Vichy area of France, and they try and capture the French fleet. And the French fleet, to their great credit, they scuttle all their ships. So German tanks are literally advancing through the streets of Toulon, and the French sailors scuttle all their ships. And a couple of them manage to escape, but mostly they go to the bottom of the harbour and they keep this very potent naval force out of the hands of the Germans. From this point on, the whole of France will be under the direct control of the Nazis, with all that entails. And what the Germans also do, which is what the Allies were hoping they wouldn't, is start to occupy the French territories in North Africa as well. And this is probably the main shortcoming of Allied intelligence around Torch. And there is a rosy assumption that it would be strategically foolish for the Germans to put troops into North Africa when the Allies are trying to do the same thing. You know, they can't win that battle. So they'd be reinforcing failure to do that. But that interpretation underestimates Hitler's willingness to act illogically and, you know, his resistance to ever admitting defeat or accepting a retreat.
Mm-hmm.
So looking at North Africa and seeing it's about to fall into Allied hands, the Germans actually start pouring troops in. And they do this by air initially. They land troops at the airport in Tunis. And the French are in such a disorganized state, they're not really in a position to put up much resistance. And later on, troops are arriving by sea as well. So they manage to capture this key area around Tunis and a good foothold on the North African coast, which they're able to expand out. In the meantime, of course, Rommel is retreating from Egypt, and those two forces will join up. The Germans try and push inland from Tunis, but by this point, the French are getting organised. They're putting up resistance, now fighting for the Allies. And they're able to hold the Germans back about 20 miles outside Tunis, long enough for Allied forces to reach that area. And they've advanced overland all the way from Algeria, so it's something like 1,000 miles.
Wow.
We start to see the really profound logistical challenges of operating in this part of the world. And the Allies try and capture Tunis and push the Germans back somewhat before the pendulum swings back the other way and things sort of end up in stalemate. The Allies are sort of within touching distance of Tunis, but they haven't captured it. And they're not going to be able to capture it for several months.
The American invasion force has made landings at Oran and Algiers on the north coast of French North Africa and somewhere on the west coast. These first official details came in a War Department communique released about an hour ago, which listed the generals commanding the American units under Commander-in-Chief Lieutenant General Ike Eisenhower. Among the commands are Brigadier General Jimmy Doolittle for air and one of America's foremost tank experts, Major General George S. Patton, commanding the forces landing on the West Coast, an indication that formidable armored units spearhead our attack. The Vichy radio supplied some details of the landings on the West Coast. They say that bridgeheads have been established both north and south of Casablanca, at Rabat in the north and at Safi in the south. And from the French reports, it's apparent that landing operations of a major scale are going on. Vichy also confirmed the landings on the north coast at Oran and Algiers. There can be little doubt that our invasion forces are large. An earlier War Department communique made it clear that this operation has been carefully planned over a period of months, and nothing has been left out. Vichy reports already admit that some French troops revolted against the Vichy command, and there were broadcasts over the Casablanca radio reportedly asking Frenchmen to cooperate with the American invasion forces. We also have learned to use the fifth column.
This sounds really messy, really difficult. Was intelligence able to at least clarify some of this or make some of this a little easier or help those commanders on the ground in any way?
Well, they're certainly trying. Tactical why should be really important in this period because it can track the enemy build-up, it can track where their forces are, it's meant to be rapid and responsive to the situation on the ground, and it's not dependent on good communications with Britain, like Ultra is. Mm-hmm. But tactical why turns into a bit of a damp squib because of the inexperience of everyone involved. They just don't know the trade well enough.
Is it the inexperience of the members of the tactical Y teams or the commanders making the decisions?
It's literally because these members of the army or the air force on the ground tasked with intercepting enemy communications, they just haven't got a lot of experience. They're actually not given very good information about the state of the enemy communications or their codes. They don't understand the enemy networks, for example. They're having to learn that on the job. They're duplicating a lot of work done by the 8th Army because they don't understand which networks are important and which are already being covered by other forces. So there's a lack of communication there. And they're not getting a lot of support from personnel in the Middle East because those personnel are busy doing their own thing in Egypt. We've got a quote from one of the men on the ground, which illustrates how these Y units are working. They're well trained in the basic technicalities of the job, but they lack real world experience about how things actually happen on the ground, which you can only really gain through hard experience.
The chief weakness of many intelligence officers arriving from England is that they appear to place more importance on scholarship than soldiering. They know how the enemy should be organised, but not how he behaves.
Extract from Major James Mark from Military Intelligence Organisation by Eric Mockler-Ferryman.
And just to back that up, there's another quote from David Hunt, who's another intelligence officer in North Africa at this point in Algeria, who says of the staff working in Algiers at the main headquarters, they did not know what they ought to be doing, and they'd learned a whole lot of things which they ought not to be doing. So the people who've been in the Middle East for a long time doing intelligence can see all these pitfalls. They've learned them before, but the people in Tunisia and in Algeria, they don't quite understand what they're meant to be doing yet. And to be fair, it's a difficult situation to learn in. The situation is so fluid that the access networks are popping up and then disappearing again almost as quick as they can keep track of them. So that's difficult. The terrain causes problems because it's hard to intercept signals in the sort of mountainous terrain that you find in that part of North Africa. There are logistics problems where equipment gets lost on ships that are sunk, or it's at the bottom of the cargo hold so it doesn't come out for weeks after it's needed. There are these basic logistics cock-ups which probably happen in every invasion during the war. And so the result is that you've got good people, but they have to learn their trade very quickly in very tough conditions, and the results are not really as they'd hoped.
So the SLUs, the special liaison units, were they having problems too?
Yeah, they tend to lose out, and this is something that happens much later on as well in Northwest Europe. They tend to put them in awkward situations near the headquarters that aren't very convenient. So at Gibraltar, they're a mile from the headquarters, apparently halfway up the rock. So every time they receive a signal, they have to go all the way down the hill to hand it over and then all the way back up the hill. So that's not convenient. When Eisenhower's headquarters moves to Algiers, they set up in the St. George Hotel in Algiers. And the SLU has one suite of the hotel, which you'd think would be quite a plum billet. But they don't have enough space and they have to set up their Typex installation actually in one of the bathrooms. And there are accounts of the bathtub being full of Typex tape after they've been handling a lot of traffic in a short period of time. So they're not working in brilliant conditions. In other cases, with the armies that are trying to push to Tunis as quickly as possible, the fighting troops are operating sometimes hundreds of miles away from their headquarters. And sometimes the SLUs are not operating close to their headquarters they're meant to be serving. So everyone's too far apart. The communications aren't in place for these people to talk to each other. It's all very, very disjointed at this point in the war. But things do seem to have gone better at the main headquarters as far as those intelligence advisors are concerned, and especially when Commander Humphreys, he receives mention in a few places for being very capable and being able to, for example, look at traffic and predict enemy air raids before they happen. So Eisenhower and the men around him seem to be doing quite a good job at reading enemy intentions and reading the progress of the battle. But as far as supporting the troops at the front line are concerned, things aren't going quite so well.
Our part of the war is going to winter around the Mediterranean. The Axis forces are already spread thin, and this will spread them even more. The key to the whole operation, carefully timed to coincide with the offensive in Egypt, is Tripoli. Tripoli in Allied hands would mean the end of Axis hopes in Africa. The secret of this operation was well kept. Many knew something was coming, but few knew where and when. But tonight, radio transmitters are hot, carrying the message to the continent. Tonight's news will lift British hearts, but there will be no final flourish of trumpets. This may be the turning point of the war, but the road to this point has been long and hard. And every child here knows that Germany must finally be beaten on the continent. We went to Africa because we had the stuff to go there. There is no news about resistance encountered, but there is no reason to think it will not be stubborn. The people who are running this operation did not expect a picnic. This action may not fully satisfy the Russians, but at least they knew all about it in advance. It's a combined operation, launched after careful planning. We chose the time, the place, and the ground. This offensive is commanded by General Ike Eisenhower, and he is not a man to look back. I have heard him say that when units of his army went anywhere, there would be no coming back. If ever a general enjoyed the confidence and respect of his troops, it's Ike Eisenhower. This is the second installment of the offensive phase. There will be others, and probably before very long. But this is no time for speculation.
So it seems to be quite a mixed bag in really quite tough conditions all round. What happens next? Were the Allies successful in capturing Tunis?
No, they are held back about 20 miles away from Tunis. And, you know, it is North Africa, but even in that part of the world, the winters are pretty tough. So the weather sets in and it's a very difficult winter. And in that situation, neither side is really in a position where they can attack. They both kind of hunker down and start to build up their forces. And Africa is really big.
I mean, that's true. Yeah. It cannot be denied.
The distance between the places where the Allies have landed in Morocco and Algeria are about 1,000 miles from Tunis, which they're trying to capture. And again, it's about 1,000 miles from El Alamein in Egypt to the Tunisian border, which 8th Army is advancing to. So the distances are vast. And it just takes time and a lot of effort to move those distances and then set up your communications, your logistics, and things like airfields that you need to, you know, just do the very basics of fighting the war, let alone win battles. And it takes the Allies until spring to resolve all those problems and get in a position where they're ready to really continue the campaign. And actually, what's ironic is because we know the Axis lose the battle in Tunisia due to logistics, in the beginning, they're in a really good position. They've got access to good ports and good airfields. They're operating a lot closer to Italy than they were before in Libya and Egypt. So it's a very short run over from Sicily over to Tunis. So they can bring in supplies very easily. They've got quality airfields that they need, so they've got local air superiority and they can keep lots of planes operational. Whereas the Allies are operating off sort of improvised runways, which aren't paved, for example, which deteriorate in the weather. So they have all these problems that the Axis don't have. And this is why for a time during the winter, the momentum swings back in favour of the Axis and the Allies really are on the back foot in Tunisia.
Do the Allies have a range issue as well with aircraft that, as you say, it's really big? So
yeah, so you can keep, you know, your smaller aircraft, your fighters and your light bombers fairly close to the front, but on these improvised airstrips, your heavy bombers and things, they need to operate from Algeria. And it's 600 miles or longer from where the front line ends up. That 600 miles is actually further than the distance from London to Berlin. So the Allied bombers are having to operate at extreme range. So they have a couple of hours to fly before they can even reach their targets, whereas the Germans are able to take off and hit a target within about half an hour. So they're much more responsive. The control of the air during this campaign is going to be one of the key defining features, and it's one of the areas the Allies are going to have to gain the advantage before they're going to be able to win.
For 10 epoch-making days, Casablanca became the solar plexus of Anglo-American leadership. The Anfa Hotel was the meeting place when Premier Churchill and President Roosevelt, accompanied by the chiefs of staff of the two countries, laid plans for this year's offensive. The combined staffs were in almost constant session. Admiral of the Fleet Sir Dudley Pound, General Sir Alan Brooke, and Air Chief Marshal Sir Charles Portal for Britain, Admiral King, General Marshal, and General Arnold for the USA, Sir John Dill, General Somerville, Lord Louis Mountbatten, these and many others formed the imposing assembly which gathered in Casablanca. Mr. Churchill arrives for the press conference held in the grounds overlooking the Atlantic. At this informal meeting with the press, a new phrase was born: unconditional surrender for the Axis. What an indication of the heartening situation now prevailing. The Casablanca conference will greatly add to Germany's concern for the immediate future. In other words, they don't like the look of 1943 at all. They have reason to fear it. In the fourth year of war, It's the Allies and not the Axis who are demanding unconditional surrender. Germany faces invasion today, not Britain. The ring is closing in on the Reich, and there won't be much left of it when the smash comes. Between 20 and 30 Allied service chiefs have already made plans for moves which will spell crisis in Germany.
In the meantime, during the winter, you have some reorganisations that go on, though, on the Allied side. You have the Casablanca Conference in January. It takes place in Morocco. And this is the conference, actually, where they decide that the war will be ended with an unconditional surrender by the Germans. They're not going to make a peace before the enemy surrender unconditionally. At this point in history, that's actually quite a new concept. And the First World War, of course, had ended with an armistice. It hadn't ended with a surrender. So the idea they're going to fight to the bitter end, and they're going to not stop until Germany has basically ceased to exist as a country and as a regime, is an important step in setting the future course of the war. And they also agree that after they're finished in North Africa, they'll invade Sicily, and that will be the next step in their plans. And they also undergo some military reorganisations. So all of the forces in North Africa now come under a single command, 18th Army Group under General Alexander. And that makes it easier to coordinate between the 8th Army in the east and the other forces that have landed during Operation Torch. They also reorganise the air forces. This is an important step because they organise the air forces, British and American, on the basis of what they've learned worked in Egypt. And what the RAF in Egypt had learned was everything stems from air superiority. Once you get command of the air, you can do whatever you want. You can stop the enemy air forces operating, and then you can attack their ground forces at will. But this requires concentrating your air forces and winning that air battle. The air forces in Algeria and Tunisia, they'd not been following the same doctrine at all. They'd been trying to carry out bombing at the same time as trying to control the air. They'd been spreading their forces too thinly. So there are people from Egypt who come in and say, this is not the way to approach it. We need to do things in a different way. And because of the incorporation of American air forces into this effort, it means that those lessons that the British have learned in Egypt are very, very quickly disseminated throughout the American Air Force as well, and that will all be very, very important to its later success in the war. So there are important changes that go on in the winter which set the stage for victory in the spring.
The Allies have had this opportunity to reorganise. The Germans and Italians, were they regrouping or building up at the same time?
Yeah, so contrary, of course, to Allied expectations, they're building up forces in Tunisia. What the Axis are trying to do is hold on to Tunisia as long as possible. Of course, the sensible Axis generals know that this is probably an untenable position in the long term. But Hitler's insistent they're not going to give up North Africa without a fight. So what we see is the Axis forces secure a sort of C-shaped perimeter in Tunisia. You have mountains in the north near Tunis, and in the west and in the south, where the British 8th Army's finally arrived at the Tunisian border. And in the middle, you've got this coastal plain, which has a lot of airfields, but it is pretty much indefensible. So they're holding this C-shaped perimeter against the Allies. And actually, they're trying to build up their forces so they can strike first, because now the Allies are experiencing the same sort of logistical problems that Rommel always had in Egypt. They're on the back foot, and Rommel spots an opportunity to strike first.
That carol came from some of the men of the 8th Army, and it was sung from the borders of Tripolitania. We are here, we've just pulled off the coast road that goes along there towards Sirte and ultimately to Tripoli, and over by our recording truck there have come one or two men of the 8th Army, and they're led by a corporal. I can see him there in his great coat and tin hat playing a clarinet, as you've just heard, and they've just been having a bit of a sing-song. And we've recorded this bit of it. As a matter of fact, they've been singing all kinds of songs with a bit of a difficulty in getting them to sing a carol at all, to be quite honest. And I don't want you to get the impression that the 8th Army is just having a nice picnic and is going gaily singing carols up the coast road after Rommel. They're not at all. They're far too busy fighting this war, and a grim enough business it is, and all this sand and dreary desert, and they've very little time for singing at all. We are a good way at the moment behind our forward troops, who certainly won't be going about caroling tonight. And Christmas, although it will be remembered and celebrated in the desert, won't, to be quite honest, be an affair of plum puddings and merry crackers and parties and good feasting for the men of the 8th Army.
So with the weather improved and this chance to reorganise a bit, can you tell us some more about how the Allies picked up the offensive?
Well, it's not the Allies who attack first. This is always the danger with Rommel. He's the sort of general who always takes an opportunity to cause this enemy problems. So Rommel's now in the situation the Allies were always in North Africa, where he's got the superior forces, local superiority, he's got air support, and it's his enemy who are strung out, who have small forces that are not able to mutually support each other and are looking pretty vulnerable to attack. So Rommel does what Rommel does, which is attack. And he first turns to the Americans. And this is one of the most notorious intelligence failures of this campaign, because there are signs in Ultra and in the tactical SIGINT of what's coming, but the Allies aren't able to formulate an accurate prediction of what the Germans are planning on doing. Partly that's because there isn't a firm plan among the Axis either. And Rommel, as usual, isn't telling the Axis high command in Rome exactly what he's planning to do. And at the very last minute, he says, I'm not going to launch my offensive after all, and then changes his mind a couple of hours after he sends this message back to Rome. But Bletchley Park only reads the message cancelling the operation. It doesn't read the message he sends saying, oh no, wait, I've changed my mind. So he launches this attack on the Americans at Kasserine, which is a notorious name for the American army. This is the first real occasion the Americans come up with German forces in big numbers. And they don't come out of it looking fantastic. And they retreat about 50 miles with heavy losses. They, again, just don't have the experience of fighting hardened German troops yet at this point. You can't criticise the men on the ground for losing out in that situation. And in the end, actually, they do succeed in kind of blunting the German assault, causing quite heavy losses on Rommel as well. And he never gets as far as he wants to, and it never turns into a complete rout that undermines the Allied position in North Africa. So it doesn't really achieve its objectives. But he does give the American forces a bit of a bloody nose at Kasserine. Yeah, we have to realise the American army, it was very, very small before the war. It's been built up from almost nothing in the space of less than a year. It's full of draftees who are completely inexperienced and commanders who are quite inexperienced. They have pre-war equipment in many cases that is probably just about adequate, but it's not really as good as you'd like. The enemy have air superiority, they've got experienced troops, they've got good equipment, which has been tested in battle before. So the Americans don't have many advantages in this battle, and the result reflects that. But what's interesting, especially for us, as an outcome of Kasserine, is its impact on the intelligence work. Now, Ralph Bennett looks at this battle through the Ultra. That's his spiel. He reads all the Ultra messages, and he works out what the Allies knew. And his conclusion is as follows. He says, only by making unjustifiable use of wisdom after the event can the riddle of conflicting and incoherent intelligence before Kasserine be solved even today. Probably at no juncture in the last 4 years of the war was a body of intelligence so hard to interpret correctly. So, you know, he says it was a difficult job for anyone to do, and the staff, as we've heard in North Africa, were inexperienced at even the basics of the work they were doing. So it doesn't reflect badly on them that they couldn't predict what the Germans were about to do.
The British 8th Army is pushing on toward the Merritt Line, but there have been new Axis gains in central Tunisia. Now for news direct from French North Africa, Admiral Radio takes you to CBS Algiers, Charles Collingwood reporting.
This is Charles Collingwood in North Africa. The Germans have already dented our North Tunisian line. After we beat off an attack on the Kasserine Pass day before yesterday, the Germans attacked again yesterday, and this time they took the pass. Today's communique speaks of local enemy gains in this area, but we know they have a pass. Heavy fighting is still going on, and British armored forces have moved down to reinforce the American units in the Kasserine area. It is just possible that the Germans may not be able to hold on to their new gains. We can't tell until we know the results of today's fighting. At the moment, all we know is that the Germans have the Kasserine pass.
However, Eisenhower thought he knew what the problem was. He thought there were major shortcomings in the way intelligence was interpreted. And this is all laid out by a war diary kept by a member of his headquarters staff, Harry Butcher.
An explanation of the defeat, as seen by Ike, lies in a misinterpretation of radio messages we regularly intercept from the enemy. This source is known as Ultra. It happens that our G2, Brigadier Mockler Ferryman, relies heavily upon this source. It has frequently disclosed excellent information as to the intentions of the Axis. However, the interpretation placed by G2 on the messages dealing with the place of attack, an attack that has been expected several days, led Mokler ferrymen to believe a feint would be made where the attack actually occurred through Sidi Bouzid, and that the real and heavy attack would come farther north. Our reconnaissance and air observations plainly showed the massing of tanks and troops, presumably for attack, in the Sidi Bouzid area, but did not show considerable additional forces, particularly tanks, which had been cleverly hidden. Basing his judgment on the reliability of Ultra, Mokler ferryman was confident the main attack would come to the north. As a result, General Anderson kept in reserve approximately half of the 1st Armored Division to meet an attack that never came. The result was that the other half of the 1st Armored Division was chewed up by the overwhelming forces, particularly by Mark VI tanks, Tigers. Now we are told by General Paget that Mokler ferryman had been released by him for lack of imagination. He said he was surprised Mach had been assigned to Torch. He suggests sending his relief another British G2, whom he describes as knowing how Germans think and act, as he was for a considerable time military attaché in Berlin. General Paget left this morning en route to the UK and is to handle with Sir Alan Brooke the replacement of Mach in such a manner that he will not be discredited. His error was simply a misinterpretation of the meaning of the intercepted German messages. However, Ike insists we need a G2 who is never satisfied with his information, one who procures it with spies, reconnaissance, and any means available. Ike thinks Mach relied too heavily upon one source of information, the intercepts. Extract from the War Diary of Harry Butcher, Naval Aide to General Dwight D. Eisenhower, from 1942 to 1945.
So Mokler ferryman, he's clearly capable and he's got good experience of intelligence. And the people who appointed him thought he would perform well in the role, but he's fallen into one of these pitfalls. He's too reliant on the Ultra. And he's too credulous and he doesn't question the intelligence enough. And therefore he makes the wrong interpretation. And actually Eisenhower's own account of this episode, it suggests an additional factor because he talks about how the belief that the main attack was to come through Fondouk, i.e. not at Kasserine, persisted both at 1st Army headquarters and, as I later learned, at the G2 division at Allied Force headquarters, that's Eisenhower's headquarters. So the problem is not so much that the interpretation was wrong, but then Mokler ferryman stuck with that interpretation even when events on the ground were beginning to prove that he got it wrong. So Eisenhower wants somebody who's more flexible and who's going to question the intelligence more, ironically. And so Mokler ferryman is removed. He goes on to great things. He goes on to work with SOE. He writes an official manual of army intelligence after the war. So he goes on to continue with a successful career. And this has led to suggestions that he was sacked to sort of balance out the sacking of the American commander on the ground at Kasserine, because he's also sacked. And Stephen E. Ambrose, the writer of Band of Brothers, and also the biographer of Eisenhower, has suggested that they needed to sack a British officer to balance out sacking of an American officer.
Sort of diplomatic balance there.
Yeah, but I don't think there's much in that. There's plenty of evidence that Eisenhower just didn't think Mokler ferryman was really working at his headquarters. Mokler ferryman's replacement is Kenneth Strong. He's also served as head of intelligence for Home Forces in the UK. But when he arrives in North Africa, it turns out he's a bit of an Americaphile. Is that the word?
Americanophile?
Americanophile? Can you say that? You can say Anglophile. He likes Americans. He gets on with them really well. The point is, when he arrives in North Africa, Strong comes to really like the Americans he's working with. You know, they get on really well. There are good personal connections there in a way that don't seem to have been with Mokler ferryman. And this is something we see in intelligence all the time, is that personality matters. And Strong and Eisenhower build up a really good working relationship. And Eisenhower appreciates his expertise and trusts him. And Strong perhaps has more of the sensible caution towards the intelligence than Mokler ferryman did. And that means the partnership really works. They work together well until the end of the war. It's a really important partnership to the conduct of the rest of the war that's established at this point. So maybe a happy side effect of the almost defeat at Kasserine.
You said right at the start of the podcast that Eisenhower was quite rightly quite sceptical, I suppose, of putting too much faith in Ultra. Working with Strong, did that opinion persist then throughout the war, this wish for far more scrutiny, I suppose, of the Ultra?
Yeah, I think it did. But I think that's, again, that's not something to criticise him over. It was sensible. And the best users of Ultra, and this is something Bill Williams at Montgomery's headquarters exhibits as well, they did treat the intelligence with a pinch of salt. They did try and contextualise it properly. They did understand that it wasn't the be-all and end-all. That's what makes a good analyst. It's the same at Bletchley, of course, with the Humphrey analysts as well. We know Eisenhower really appreciated Ultra because we have his letter to Edward Travis at the end of the war saying it saved thousands of British and American lives. But That doesn't mean to say he was an unbridled enthusiast for it. He was just sensible about it. I think that was the right way to go.
We have not so far this war taken as many German prisoners as they have taken British. But these German prisoners will no doubt come in droves at the end, just as they did last time. I have never promised anything but blood, tears, toil, and sweat. Now, however, we have a new experience. We have victory. A remarkable and definite victory. A bright gleam has caught the helmets of our soldiers and warmed and cheered all our hearts. The late Monsieur Venizela observed that in all our wars, England, he ought to have said Britain, of course, England always wins one battle, the last. We seem to have begun rather earlier this time. General Alexander, with his brilliant comrade and lieutenant, General Montgomery, has gained a glorious and exciting victory in what I think should be called the Battle of Egypt. Rommel's army has been defeated. It has been routed. It has been very largely destroyed as a fighting force. Ah, this is not the end. It is not even the beginning of the end. But it is perhaps the end of the beginning.
Meanwhile, tell us what was going on with Montgomery and Rommel in Tunisia.
So after Kasserine, Rommel's tried a spoiling attack against the Americans to disrupt them, and that's gone okay. So then he tries to do the same thing with the British, and by this point, the British 8th Army is at the Tunisian border, at one end of that C-shaped perimeter, and he decides to attack them at a place called Medinine. But in contrast to Kasserine, Medinine is sort of the model ultra battle in that the Allies have, again, perfect intelligence about what Rommel's planning, and Montgomery gets clear warning. He's able to amend some shortcomings in his defences because, again, his forces are strung out all the way along the coast of Africa in order to keep them supplied. So he's forced to rush tanks up to the front line and dig in defences, get his anti-tank guns in the right positions before the attack is launched. When Rommel attacks, he's utterly defeated. He loses about a third of his tanks in North Africa, about 50 tanks, makes no progress, captures no ground at all, inflicts very few casualties on the British. And that's his final battle in North Africa. And quite notoriously at this point, Rommel sort of hangs his head and slinks back to Germany in shame and gives up on North Africa. He's also ill, and that's the official kind of propaganda explanation for him leaving North Africa. But this is the kind of battle that kind of breaks his will to fight the war in North Africa. He says, okay, we've lost. And it's only a matter of time before the Axis in Tunisia are going to be eliminated. So Montgomery follows this up with his own attack on the Marif line. This is the French defensive line, was built before the war to protect Tunisia from the Italians in Libya, and now it's been used by the Germans to hold back the British. And he's using Ultra and Tactical Y to give him evidence about the supply situation of the enemy and their defensive arrangements, and after some battering away at this line and not breaking through frontally, he carries out this flanking manoeuvre with the New Zealand division. They find passes through the mountains which get them kind of onto the flank of the enemy, and they're able to unhinge the position and break through into that coastal plain in central Tunisia. So they're making real progress at this point.
So they're gaining ground. Is this coming easily, or is this a really hard fight bit by bit?
I mean, they're not having an easy time of it. And the Germans and the Italians as well have been, again, as I said before, pouring troops in. Their numbers are still going up. So they had about 150,000 combat troops in Tunisia in February and 167,000 in March. So they're actually getting greater in number. And what the Allies are doing in this period, as well as pushing forward, they're turning the tables in logistical terms on the Axis. As the Axis have been in a very good position, able to bring troops and supplies over that short hop from Sicily. And things have looked very positive for them. So the Allies are trying to cut off those lifelines. They're using their naval forces to sink shipping. In December, you have a battle which actually features in our new exhibition, the Battle of Skirky Bank, which takes place in the strait between Sicily and Tunisia, where Allied destroyers sink a convoy going over to North Africa. It's operations such as that that force the Axis to use a narrow naval channel protected by minefields. But then that's vulnerable to Allied air attack because then they know exactly where the ships are going to be. So these different ways of interdicting the logistics are all complementing each other. And they're really starting to constrain the amount of supplies the Axis are able to get through to North Africa. They attack ports in Sicily to force the Axis to sail from mainland Italy instead of from Sicily. As the Allies sink ships, they have a disproportionate effect because the Germans are not just running out of ships, they're running out of crews willing to risk the crossing, risk being bombed or torpedoed on the way over. So shipping really takes a nosedive. And it's at this point that the Axis are becoming more and more reliant on air transport.
The Maref line feels the weight of our guns. Rommel sends his Ju-88s in a belated attempt to stave off danger from behind the Maref line. He pays a high price in planes. Too late, he discovers himself in a precarious position. The El Hammer thrust has tricked him again. With Rommel's attention fixed on Maref, Montgomery switches big concentrations round to clinch the blow at El Hammer. A brilliant maneuver which sent our main attack across more than 200 miles of treacherous country in a giant encircling movement. A perilous venture, and one which Rommel underestimated.
You'd said to us how vital air superiority is. Does it really show itself at this point now about how control of the air, particularly in this crossing point, is key?
Yeah, absolutely. At this point in the campaign, it's a campaign winner, basically. The problem the Axis are having is they're so reliant on these aircraft, they're having to deploy fighters to protect them from the Allies, but that gives the Allies more freedom to attack where they want, whether it's with bombers or with fighters, to interdict the air transport. So the Allies are starting to get in a position where they have the air superiority, and they're able to attack as and where they want. But again, this is a part of the campaign which has really important support from intelligence coming out of Bletchley Park. And eventually the Allies launch an operation called Operation Flax to decisively interdict the Axis air transport, shoot down as many planes as possible and stop them bringing in supplies, cut off that last line of supply. And traditionally, the credit for this is given to Ultra. That is, they know when the aircraft are going to be taken off and where they're going to be in the air so they can shoot them down because Ultra's telling them. But I've done a bit of work looking into this and it's more accurate to say Ultra gives them a good motivation for the operation because it tells them how reliant the Axis are on their air transport and how little fuel and ammo they've got, and shows how much of a vulnerability it is. But it doesn't allow them to carry out the operation because the flights of aircraft are not the sort of intelligence you normally get from Ultra. I think we have a really interesting untold story of how this intelligence is produced at Bletchley Park, which is separate from the Ultra system of Hut 3 and Hut 6 that we know so well. And it actually relates to the air section at Bletchley Park. Air section is one of the kind of pre-war remnants in GCNCS. At the start of the war, there's an army section, a naval section, and an air section. And they all keep on going when war breaks out. An air section at the start of the war is reading all these, what they call low-grade codes and ciphers used by the German Air Force. And these are fairly simple codes that relate to the kind of basic tactical movements, their air-to-ground communications and things like that. They're not on the same level and the same importance as Ultra if you look at an individual message. But as we see in this instance, that information can be built up to produce quite potent intelligence. At the end of 1942, air section break a new code used by the Germans, and they call this code Auchinleck, after General Auchinleck, who we mentioned earlier, we think. I don't know why, maybe they were fans of General Auchinleck and not fans of Montgomery, who replaces him.
Is this related in any way to AUKA code, which we've spoken about before, A-U-K-A, just thinking about the A-U-K letters at the beginning here?
Well, maybe there's a connection there, because there is definitely a connection between these two code groups. AUKA, or AUKA, is probably the most common low-grade German code. And it's used by all sorts of bomber and reconnaissance units for their everyday operations. And the way this code works is that you look up the meaning of your message in a code book and you encode it in a very simple way. And then you recode it using a daily table, which changes every day. And that means you can use the same code book for a few months at a time and just change the daily table and keep your code fairly secure. The connection between AUKA and Auchinleck is that they use the same recoding table, even though the underlying code book is different. They are sharing the recoding tables. So there's a connection there which Air Section can exploit. And when they realise that connection, it leads to a wholesale reorganisation of what they're doing. Because it's the case now that if you manage to reconstruct an element of one code, it might tell you what's happening in the other code. And the Germans roll out a similar system with all their low-grade codes eventually. And Air Section end up calling these the orchestra. And they codename all the individual codes after musical instruments.
So we have Orca, Orkinlek, and orchestra. There seems to be a bit of a theme.
Perhaps a verbal theme.
Yeah.
So the Orkinlek code, even though this hasn't quite happened yet, it's the first orchestral code which will be worked on in Air Section. And what the Germans use the Orkinlek for is for their transport flights. Every time a plane takes off and every time it lands, they broadcast this information. And it's used for administration, basically. It's used to let them keep track of where their aircraft are. That's not normally very sensitive information, because just knowing where one aircraft is not going to change the course of the war. It's just not hot button information like Ultra is. But what Air Section realise is that what if you get the record of every aircraft taking off and landing, mm-hmm. and you amalgamate them all together, because they're intercepting thousands of these messages every day. What if you built up that big picture? What could you learn from that? The problem they have, of course, is they've got too few personnel to go through all these messages manually. So who's going to amalgamate all that information together? And this is when we encounter our old friend Hollerith.
Remind us, what is Hollerith?
Hollerith is a system of punch card processing devices.
Device makes them sound small. These are not small machines.
They're not small. I mean, the basic machine is a sorter, and it's about the size of a lounge piano, and some are bigger than that. You can feed these machines information on punch cards, and they can sort and process it in various different ways that are very useful for government, for running censuses, for example, for businesses like banks. And also, it turns out, in code breaking. And there's a big installation of Hollerith machines at Bletchley Park, which they've been using for code breaking from the very earliest stage of the war. They used them in the First World War as well. The interesting thing about this story about Orkinlek and Operation Flax is that it's an application of Hollerith to intelligence work. Because normally, its impact is on cryptanalysis. You can sort ciphertext and you can look for features which then your crippies can exploit. But the myth about Hollerith at Bletchley Park is that it's used to run a central index of all the information Bletchley learns. And there's this idea that you can go down to Block C. You can go to a sort of hole in the wall where there is a lady who will take your information request and she will go through and run routines on the machines that will magic up the information you need. Mm-hmm. The problem with this idea is that there's no evidence that it ever happened or that Hollerith was ever used to run an index. This idea is a really attractive one because it seems very fitting that Bletchley Park would sort of have its own Google that would search through all its intelligence and tell people what they needed to know. But the problem with this idea is that there's no evidence for it. Every piece of information we have about the Hollerith section points to it being used in cryptanalysis, but not for indexing. And in reality, indexing is done in many different places across the park. You have indexes for all sorts of different specialist areas. You don't really need a central index because everyone here is a specialist in a particular area. You don't need your Luftwaffe intelligence experts to go and learn about the Japanese Navy. There's just no need. So they just have an index on the German Air Force, which they run themselves, or allow certain skilled staff specialists to run it. They bring in librarians, people who have experience of running databases, and they do indexing by hand on index cards, writing in pen and pencil. It's very, very manual, actually. However, Operation Flax is one occasion, and I think the only occasion I can find, maybe the exception that proves the rule, where they do use Hollerith to process intelligence in a way. So the process is as follows. They get intercepted Orkinlek messages and they decode them. And then when they decoded them, they lay out each message in a pro forma document with all the various pieces of information. What's the identity of the aircraft that's taken off? By this point, they understand all of that. They understand fuselage numbers and call signs so they can identify consistently which aircraft is which. Where's it taken off from? Where's it going? What are the timings? And so on. And these pro forma documents go over to the Hollerith section, where somebody punches them up. And there are instructions that are laid down that all the information has to be consistent. It has to be written in the largest text possible, in block capitals, very, very clearly, because it's going to go to a barely trained member of the Hollerith team who knows nothing of the context of this, who's just going to punch the information onto a card. And once you've got all of these messages on Hollerith cards, you can start sorting them. What they do then is sort all of these cards by three criteria from the airbase of origin, and then by the destination airbase, and then by the time. And you have to do them in that order because they're doing something called a radix sort, which the mathematically minded of our listeners will know about. But this is the idea that you can sort a complex set of information using a simple process by starting with the least significant piece of information and moving upwards. So if you imagine three-digit numbers, a series of three-digit numbers between 1 and 999, you can sort by the 1 column, and then you can sort by the tens, and you can sort by the hundreds, and you'll find those numbers are all in the correct order. But you only have to sort one digit at a time. And this is exactly what they're doing. It works with numbers just as it does with information in this case. When they sort in that order, they get a nice neat list of flights from every airbase sorted by destination and in time order. And then a intelligence officer in air section can look at that list and very quickly work out where the main flights are taking place and where they're going. It'll look at the flow of aircraft around their various bases in the Mediterranean, going back and forth to North Africa. And then they can say, well, they always do a morning flight at about 5:30 or 6:30 in the morning. They do a mid-morning or late morning flight of the heavier transport aircraft, and then they always do an afternoon flight between about 2 and 4 in the afternoon. And this is the information the intelligence officers at the commands in North Africa need to organise Operation Flax, that interdiction operation, and shoot down those aircraft. The reason they have to get this intelligence right is they're not in a situation where they can just fly around and hope they bump into the enemy. The Axis aircraft are only in the air for a couple of hours. The Allies simply don't have enough planes to cover the straits for long enough and hope to run into the enemy. And if they do, it will be a small number of aircraft against a big enemy formation surrounded by fighter escorts. Another factor is the Germans could be flying at night. They have that capability, but they're flying during the day because they think the Allies don't have the intelligence they need to intercept the flights. And if the Allies disabuse them of that notion, the enemy can just flip to night flying. And it's less efficient, but they can still bring in a good volume of supplies that way. So when the Allies make their effort to launch down the aircraft, it needs to be decisive. They need to, in a shorter period as possible, shoot down as many aircraft as they can to fatally weaken the enemy transport fleet before they can realise what's going on, realise the Allies are quite capable of intercepting their flights, and then switch to night flying. And they're poised to do this in February 1943, but then the Battle of Kasserine happens and all the aircraft are redeployed to support the ground forces and they delay things. And they're finally in a position to launch Operation Flax around the start of April. And then in the meantime, they've been keeping track of the flights, they've been looking at the routines and updating their intelligence picture. And we have good evidence from the commands in North Africa about how important intelligence is to what they're about to do. And they finally open the operation on the 5th of April. At this point, it's run by the American forces in what's called the Northwest African Strategic Air Force. And what they do is they launch a mix of fighter sweeps and bomber attacks. They will bomb an airfield to bring the enemy fighters into the air. And then when they're back on the ground refueling and rearming, they'll send their fighters over to try and catch the transports while the enemy fighters can't come up and help. And they cause quite good losses to the enemy. They're shooting down 10 or 20 aircraft here and there. And what they're doing using that intelligence coming out of Air Section of Bletchley Park is they're using what we talk about as pattern of life to plan their attacks. I've looked through all the Ultra in this period, about 4,000 messages. Sometimes you've just got to sit down and read 4,000 Ultra messages. It's a terrible job. What can I say?
You loved every second of it.
Yeah, I did. There is very little evidence at this early point of the operation that Ultra is producing anything useful as far as the timing of transport flights is concerned. So they must be basing this on routine and they're having some success, steady, if not spectacular success.
As you pointed out, low-grade intelligence doesn't necessarily mean low value if you're able to work with it.
Yes, when we talk about low-grade, we mean a low-security code or a cipher. It doesn't mean that the information it's concealing is any less valuable. As we can see in this case, it's really quite valuable sometimes.
You said that traditionally credit has been given to Ultra, but you've looked through the Ultra messages. Is this just a misunderstanding of what Ultra was or a misunderstanding of how the intelligence was gleaned from the traffic they were assessing or analysing?
Well, it certainly seems that most historians, they understand that signals intelligence is the factor, then they correlate signals intelligence with Ultra in a way that you can't justify because there's so much more that's coming out of Bletchley Park than just Ultra. But they're not completely wrong because Ultra does have a part to play in this story. From the middle of April, the Desert Air Force, those fighter forces that have been supporting 8th Army in Egypt since very early in the war, take over the operation. And by this point, Montgomery's had his breakthrough on the Marif line and they've captured that coastal plain. So they're operating from far forward airfields and they're able to join in the battle. But They're still 75 or 100 miles away from the Bay of Tunis where they're trying to intercept these transport flights. And again, they can't guarantee constant air cover. And they work out a plan that's based on the idea that if you use the entire Desert Air Force, and it's interesting, they commit a substantial proportion of their air forces in North Africa to just this one operation. If you use the entire Desert Air Force, you can cover the Bay of Tunis for an hour and a quarter at a time and hope that if you meet transports, you're going to have enough planes in the air to do serious damage to them. They take over the 16th of April, and there is very little in the history books to illustrate anything happening before the 18th of April. But the Ultra tells a slightly different story, because we have a very interesting message which tells us several things. And this is from the German air headquarters in North Africa.
TX-MSS-2441-T20 T.0.0-1914Z-17-4-1943 According to Flieger Corps Tunis at 1445 hours on the 17th, since 1330 hours, two strong Allied fighter thrusts, each of 30 to 40 Spitfires, from west and south into Gulf of Tunis and area of Cap Bon. Considered from behaviour of Spitfires that their intention could only be to intercept Junkers transport formation due to arrive 1430 hours. As countermeasure, aircraft of Jagdgeschwader 53 and Jagdgeschwader 77 operated from 1345 hours. Flieger Corps Tunis proposed that, on the 18th, the first Junkers formation should land at 0530, second formation to land 1615 hours.
So you read 4,000 messages and you do eventually find the one that's important. What this message tells us is that the Allies are doing their fighter sweeps on the 17th of April and that they're there at the right time. And it's only by sheer bad luck that they miss the transports. And this is something the Germans realise and remark on. And it must have caused a bit of consternation in Allied headquarters as well, because it gives the game away that the Germans know what they're trying to do. They know they're aiming for the transports. And they might any day decide to shift to night flying. So it looks like this whole operation might be a bit of a damp squib. But this message also contains the information the Allies are going to need to launch the decisive blow. At the end of the message, it's where they say that on the 18th, the first formation will land at 0530, the second formation will land at 1615 hours. But next to the 6 in 1615, there is strong indications. It's bracketed off from the rest of the message. And what that means is that the emenda in Hut 3 has filled a gap. They've missed the key character, they've missed the hour. So they, you know, it's quarter past one of the hours. That's either because there's been a bad transmission or a bad encodement of the information. Somewhere along the chain, they've lost that word. And our emender in Hut 3 has filled it in. And he thinks, based on pattern of life again, based on probably looking at the information coming out of air section, he thinks they're going to land at 1615. But what's interesting is that he's wrong. Even Hut 3 don't always get it right. When the Hut 3 emenders add a comment or fill in a piece of information, they're only meant to do it when they're pretty sure it's correct. And they're meant to give an indication of how sure they are. And strong indications is the strongest indication that they believe that information is factual. So he must have been pretty sure, but he's wrong. We'll find out later on from an Ultra message, which doesn't make it to North Africa in time, that the correct time should have been 1550.
Oh dear.
So what happens on the 18th of April is your fighter sweeps take off. They're flying around over the Bay of Tunis from about 1600, and the Axis transports have already arrived and landed. But they have a stroke of luck, because the very last of those flights arrives over the area at about 1700, and it catches the transports as they take off for the return journey. And this is a fact in the story I couldn't work out for a while, is why on this day they intercept the flights as they're returning, because they're normally trying to shoot them down when they're arriving before they can unload their supplies. On this occasion, they get them on the return. And one of these shoes is known as the Palm Sunday Massacre. Well, massacre is the right word. There's no effective fighter cover from the Germans. There's three squadrons of American fighters who just pounce on these transports. They're complete sitting ducks, and it's like shooting fish in a barrel. They're flying low, they can't manoeuvre, they're actually packed to the gunwales with Axis personnel trying to get back out of North Africa, and they're shooting these planes down. There are, you know, Germans firing the machine guns out the window to try and keep the fighters away, but to no effect. The planes are landing in the sea, they're crash landing on the coastline just to get out of the line of fire. And you have these accounts, you know, of planes landing in the sea and then dozens of men spewing out of the hold of the aircraft and trying to swim to the shore. It's absolute chaos. And the Allies claim about 70 planes shot down. They never shoot down that many. It's probably between 30 and 40, as usual. They overclaim. but it's still a really decisive blow to the enemy transport. But what's fascinating is the biggest impact of Ultra on this operation comes out despite the fact that the Ultra was wrong, and thanks to a big dose of luck more than anything else. Mm-hmm. There's a more conventional interception which takes place on the 22nd of April. And on this occasion, Desert Air Force does receive an Ultra message saying a flight of ME-323s is going to take off at a certain time. The ME-323 is kind of a super heavy transport aircraft. It's adapted from an enormous glider that the Germans were hoping to use. They end up not using gliders very much, so they think, why don't we stick six engines on it and use it as a transport aircraft? And this thing can carry about 10 tons of supplies. But they only have a handful of them. And they're getting so desperate by this point, they decide to send all their ME-323s into the air at the same time. And all but one of them, I think, is shot down by the British. So again, they're sitting ducks, and that's another massacre. And in terms of transport capacity, that's even more impactful than the Palm Sunday massacre. And at that point, the Germans sort of give up. They stop doing transport flights.
Well, the sheer numbers of planes coming down here, they surely can't have afforded to keep sacrificing this many.
Yeah, they do eventually switch to night flying, and then there's small-scale operations with Allied night fighters trying to shoot them down, but basically things fizzle out at this point. But they've succeeded in shooting down enough aircraft. The Germans don't have the transport capacity anymore to support their troops in North Africa. So out of an effective force of about 200 aircraft, they've shot down in total 157 of them. It's really decisive numbers we're talking about. And it means that the Luftwaffe transport fleet basically ceases to exist after this point, especially after the Battle of Stalingrad, where they've been heavily engaged. They've lost a lot of planes there. There are many occasions going forward in the war where the Germans would have really benefited from having a few cargo aircraft, and they just don't have any anymore because they've all been shot down. But what this whole story shows is that you need both types of intelligence. You need information that gives you enemy pattern of life, which in this case was a low grade, and you need the high grade, the Ultra, as well, to sometimes give you the decisive information you need to foil an enemy attack or to shoot down a transport convoy.
The North African land front is quiet, but Allied planes are hurling death and destruction on the Axis over a wide area of the Mediterranean. American Lieutenant General Spots reports that his Allied Air Force commands the skies in that battle zone. Now, for our first overseas report, Admiral Radio takes you direct to CBS Algiers. Charles Collingwood reporting.
This is Charles Collingwood at Allied Force Headquarters in North Africa. There's a lot of air activity going on over what's left of the Tunisian front, but not much else. The story of yesterday's air war sounds very much like the story of any day in the last couple of weeks. Ships and roads and dry docks. It's all so much like yesterday or the day before that it's almost boring. But that's the stuff that air superiority is made of, and that's what you get air superiority for, so that every day you can go out and sink the enemy's ships and bomb his roads and strap his troops. That's what a good air force does, and what this air force in North Africa is doing now.
So here the Axis have effectively been cut off from their supplies. Does this mean they're trapped with no support?
They are effectively trapped, and from this point on, it's only a matter of time before they collapse. They're being hemmed into an ever tighter perimeter. They've lost control of the air and control of the sea, and their men are running out of ammunition, and they've long since run out of fuel, so they can't move their tanks, for example. What we have here is, in the memorable phrase of Ronald Lewin, a Dunkirk without any ships. And it only takes until the middle of May before the Allies have mopped everything up. It's an enormous defeat for the Axis. They lose at least 250,000 men, if not 300,000, taken prisoner, which is more than were taken prisoner at Stalingrad. And even though large numbers of those men, okay, were not maybe first-rate combat troops, they're behind-the-lines people, or they're large parts of the Italian army as well. But it's still really major losses. They lose all of their equipment, of course, all of those tanks which could have been used to such effect in later battles. And the Luftwaffe in particular suffers terribly. They lose about 2,500 aircraft just in this period between November 1942 and May 1943, which is about 41% of the entire strength of the Luftwaffe.
Wow.
It's not gone quite as well as the Allies wanted, because they've been kept fighting in North Africa for several months after they wanted to be done with it and moving on to Sicily. And the Axis have kept the Mediterranean closed to traffic, so that makes it harder to take supplies to India, for example. So it's not gone as well as the Allies hoped. On the other hand, it could have gone even worse. The Axis could have held out in North Africa even longer if there hadn't been such effective interdiction of their supply lines. And I suppose that's the big contribution Bletchley Park makes to the whole battle.
Yesterday afternoon at about 4:30, the war in North Africa came to an end. Early on Tuesday morning, the Axis armies were cut clean in half by the British drive across the neck of the Cape Bon Peninsula. That left mainly the German 90th Light Division to be accounted for, a division of tough, veteran fighting troops, some of the finest fighters that ever came out of Germany. In the mountains, they went on fighting until they had little ammunition left. Our troops in the north put down a smoke screen, and under cover of it they withdrew a little, while our bombers went in three deadly waves to deliver the last aerial bombardment and one of the heaviest of the whole campaign. When our bombers had finished, our artillery opened up, and soon hundreds of white flags were appearing all over the place.
So from an intelligence perspective, what's the lesson we can learn here? What's the main, I guess, take home for us from this?
What we see is Bletchley Park's intelligence really coming into its own in this period. There are people on the ground now who really understand how to make it work and really appreciate its value. They're using various different types of intelligence, all the way from the low-grade tactical stuff to the high-grade ultra, and they're synergizing it with each other and synergizing it with the different Allied tactics in various ways, which are more and more effective. And because the Allies are not overwhelmingly powerful at this point in the war, it's a period where intelligence is especially important because it acts as a tiebreaker. It means the difference between a defeat or a narrow victory and a decisive victory. And we'll see this over the next year as well in Sicily and Italy as well, intelligence acting as a tiebreaker, letting the Allies act in a more confident and effective way than they might otherwise have done, and turning what might have been an even worse slog into campaigns which eventually they managed to succeed in. And there are, of course, impacts outside the Mediterranean as well, especially where General Eisenhower is concerned. He leaves North Africa with a good understanding of how to do intelligence, how to exploit it, and trust in how it works, and a good team around him who can help him do that. And he applies all those lessons in Northwest Europe, in D-Day and afterwards. And he comes to really appreciate this source of intelligence coming out of Bletchley, which, in his own words, saves thousands of British and American lives.
Thanks to the paid and volunteer staff, visitors and veterans who took part in this podcast. To find out more, go to bletchleypark.org.uk. You can follow Bletchley Park on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine and supported by Audioboom. If you like this podcast, please leave us a review on iTunes. Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.